I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A recent Pew Research Center poll reported that 61% of Americans support same-sex marriage and 31% oppose it. 15 years ago, the numbers were exactly reversed. A lot has happened in recent years to change the public's perception about LGBTQ rights. Back in 1969, 50 years ago, it was risky, even criminal, to be out. And that's what makes the Stonewall riots in New York City that began on June 28th such a seminal moment. Police had raided the bar before, but this night the patrons fought back, giving rights to a civil rights movement. A few years earlier in Philadelphia, beginning in 1965, local gay rights activists in professional attire organized protests on July 4th near Independence Hall, carrying signs that read, "Homosexuals should be judged as individuals," and "Support homosexual civil rights." These annual reminders, as they were called, were among the first gay rights protests in the country. On Radio Times today, from Philadelphia to New York City, from 1965 to today, we mark the 50th anniversary of Stonewall and the role that Philadelphia played, and we have three guests. Joining us from the NPR studios in New York is Mark Siegel, LGBTQ activist, founder, publisher of the Philadelphia Gay News, one of the founding members of the Gay Liberation Front. He was at Stonewall when the riots broke out, wrote a book a couple of years ago, and then I danced, in fact, was a guest on Radio Times to talk about that book. And Mark Siegel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to hear from you, Marty, from New York. Hello
to you. Also with us in here in our Philadelphia studios is Adabello, founding member of the Philadelphia chapter of the Daughters of Bilitis and its successor, the Homophile Action League. She was active volunteer in the American Library Association's Gay Task Force. She helped to organize the first walkathon for AIDS funding. That's now the AIDS Fund. And she was at the 1969 Reminder protests in Philadelphia and joins us on Radio Times. Adabello, nice to have you with us.
Very nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And rounding out our trio of guests, Bob Skiba, he's curator at the William Way Center, John T. Wilcox, Junior LGBT Archives. And Bob Skiba, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have all three of you with us. Everyone's got a very long bio here, but we made it through, and I'm happy to have you all here. And Mark, let me begin with you, because you were at Stonewall. I think you were at the bar at Stonewall when the riots broke out. What was it about Stonewall that made it so popular?
Well, I had moved to New York on May 10th, 1969, about 6 weeks before Stonewall. Like many people growing up in the 1960s, gay life was invisible. We weren't on the newspapers. We weren't in magazines, weren't on radio like this, weren't on television. We did not exist. If you wanted to find us, you would have to go to the library, and maybe if you were lucky, you might find a couple of books that talked about us as homosexuals who were illegal, immoral, and most likely insane. If you went on the street and even mentioned the fact you possibly were gay, you would probably be arrested or put in a mental institution. And many people don't talk about how bad it was for gay people at
sure.
that time. So I literally, like many other young people my age, escaped to New York, where we thought there might be gay people. And you got to remember, this is a time when the Delaware Valley had 1.6 million people, and I thought I was the only gay person there. The Reminders Day, as we talk about, weren't as good as getting out to people like me, because I had no idea they were happening, and therefore didn't know there were other gay people in Philadelphia, and I moved to New York. When you were 18 years old and you were gay in New York, your life centered around Christopher Street at that time. You would go there every night, walk up and down the street. Maybe you would stop into the Silver Diner diner and have a cup of coffee. Then you'd walk up the street. But every single night, by the end of the night, you would end up in Stonewall. And the reason you went to Stonewall was that on Christopher Street, police were still patrolling. They would stop you if you showed any kind of affection. If there were more than three of you congregating, they would stop you, or even maybe arrest you. If you were wearing the wrong gender clothing, they would arrest you or harass you. People would come in from around the tri-state area and harass or beat you up. When you went into the Stonewall, a mafia-controlled bar, an illegal bar, a dirty bar, a dirty bar that gave you watered-down drinks, a bar that was ugly, my description of it is black, red, and wood. That's the only thing
that
was in
ugly.
There. Yeah. But two things happened. Number one, you could be yourself. You could show affection to someone. And if you were like me, an 18-year-old, you did what you wanted to do, which was dance. It was the only place you could dance. So in a sense, it was a safe haven for us.
Well, I want to get back to that, but let me get our other two guests in on the conversation. And Bob, I'll start with you. What then, as Mark was describing Stonewall itself, was there an equivalent Stonewall in Philadelphia at that time?
That's an interesting question. There were several bars in Philadelphia, most of them centered in Center City, along a strip that we now call the Gayborhood, but in the 60s, people would have called it the Gay Ghetto. So we're talking about this intersection of 13th Street and Locust, which was full of seedy gay bars and seedy straight bars as well.
And how about for you, Ada, for women in Philadelphia, where could you go and be yourself, as Mark was saying?
Well, the main gay bar for lesbians was Rusty's, which was around the corner from the Forest Theater, upstairs, and they had to look at your face before they let you in, and it was like going to a secret place. But it was very popular because that was the main one that everybody knew about. But it was raided.
The police would raid it.
Oh, right. I mean, that was part of very much of the picture, was the fact that these bars were illegal just brought a lot of corruption to the police, because they were not owned by gay people.
They were owned by mobsters.
There was always, we never had any right. I mean, we actually were grateful that we could go there, because
even for the watered down drinks, as Mark would say.
Well, the watered down drinks and an environment that wasn't really very conducive to even nice conversation.
But it felt like a safe place.
Yeah, it was a safe place, and at least you could dance and you could actually get together with your friends and talk without looking behind your back to see who is listening.
Mark, let me go back to you, and we could spend a whole hour on what happened on June 28th, 1969, at the Stonewall Inn, but you were there. Why do you think that night patrons fought back?
As Otto said, these were safe places for us, and the usual, since they were gay and since they were basically illegal, even if they had a license, in New York they did not. In Philadelphia they did. But what happened, which is mutual all across the country, the police would come in, they would raid these bars, get their money, and leave. And that was the end of it. Sometimes the patrons didn't even know about it. But what was different about that night in June of 69, the police came in, and rather than having the mafia know beforehand, they basically burst in. Hmm. They came up to the patrons and slammed them up against the wall. They called us all the names that we'd heard our whole lives, faggot, fairy, dyke, queer, and just pushed people around. But what remains in my mind is what they did next, which was go up to anybody who looked prosperous or successful, ask them to take their wallet out and take the money from that wallet and put it in their pockets. And what that said to me is, what did they think of us? How did they, you know, we were the lowest of the low.
Like
what are we going to do? Call the police? Call the police? They are the police. But I was scared. I'd only been in New York 6 weeks. I looked like the kid next door. I wasn't stereotypical, or I wasn't a drag queen. Those are the people who got the worst treatment by the police. I was carted, let out. I was one of the first to be let out. I went across the street and watched. But slowly, as we got out, eventually we were 50 to 75. Anybody who looked like they were successful, were prosperous, about to be prosperous, or had family in that area, tram for the subway. The only people who were left there were street kids like me living at the YMCA at that time, drag queens, people of color, and the few radicals like Marty Robinson. Those were the people who were left. And as we were on the street, eventually the police were only six in the bar, and the workers, we were 50 to 75. Eventually they just got their money, did what they wanted to do, and wanted to leave. We basically wouldn't let them leave. We began to throw whatever was on the street. It was cans, it was stones, whatever was there. They were locked in the bar. For the first time in history, gay people had imprisoned the people who had imprisoned us.
And, Mark, you have called this a quote-unquote joyous riot.
Absolutely. That terrified kid who just a few minutes ago, inside the Stonewall, outside the Stonewall, somewhere, I became joyous, excited, and felt I could be me. I felt I could yell gay out loud in the middle of the street in New York. That was never done. We proved unity in numbers. We proved that we were empowered. It took another hour before the police had reinforcements there, and I think the reason for that is if I was a policeman in 1969, I would not like to call the police station and say, please help me, I have gay people entrapping me.
Ida, let me go back to you. What did Stonewall mean to you, or what does Stonewall mean to you?
Well, Stonewall just was like somebody had opened a window, and there was now the possibilities that didn't exist before. I think that the tactics changed.
Yes.
Because before, we were very respectful as students. The pickets were at Independence Hall.
In Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia, yeah. were like, people were so well-dressed and well-behaved that some of the people in the tourists looking at it and said, oh, those are not homosexuals, those are actors that were.
They were actors who were so well-dressed carrying these signs.
Right. I mean, obviously, I don't know what idea they had of what a homosexual looked like. Well, that was gone,
right?
Because even, you know, not only the Gay Liberation Front and the Gay Activist Alliance, they both advocated confrontation, and that made a tremendous difference. That doesn't mean that the effort within the system disappeared, because a lot of openly gay people started running for office. But at the same time, there was this other activity going up there that was on your face.
And I do want to pick up on that. And we are talking, frankly, marking the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. They began on June 28th, 1969. Also talking about the role that Philadelphia has played as we mark the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, what has been accomplished in the LGBTQ movement. And again, joining us, Ida Bello, a founding member of the Philadelphia chapter of the Daughters of Bilitis, and its successor organization, the Homophile Action League. Mark Siegel, LGBTQ activist, founder, publisher of the Philadelphia Gay News, and Bob Skiba, curator at the William Way Center's LGBT Archives. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots and the role that Philadelphia has played, and certainly played some 50 years ago when it comes to LGBTQ rights. In fact, I should just remind our listeners that back in 1965, from 65 to 69, activists who were wearing very conservative attire started a quiet protest near Independence Hall on July 4th. They were carrying placards calling for civil rights, and again considered among the country's first demonstration for gay rights. Let me play a clip, and this is Barbara Gittings. She's a Philadelphia civil rights activist. This is from an interview from the documentary Gay Pioneers by Glenn Holston.
We were the first to do this in an organized fashion, to stand up for ourselves. We were considered weird and sick and perverted and just plain wrong even most of the good straight citizens of this country had been brainwashed into thinking that we were that way. And we felt, no, we are not perverted, we're not sick, we're not weird, and we are not wrong. We are right, and the world is wrong.
Bob Skibbe, let me go back to you and put this these reminder protests, put them into some kind of context for us.
Well, the first reminder protest happened in July of 1965. We're talking about an America where there were probably a couple dozen gay activists in the country, as opposed to the thousands
and thousands. A couple dozen.
Dozen, right. On the East Coast here in Philadelphia, New York, and Washington were early homophile organizations. They used the word homophile instead of homosexual because homosexuality was the name of the disease that doctors said that people had. So people were trying to take control of the nomenclature. And these three cities formed an early organization called ECHO, Eastern Conference of Homophile Organizations. Mm-hmm. And they began talking, people like Barbara Giddings and a man named Frank Kameny, who had founded a homophile organization in Washington, said, it's time to take action. We just can't sit around and talk about why we're gay, how sick we are, and what we should do about it. What Frank said was, in America, no one hands you your rights on a silver platter. You have to fight like hell to get them, and you have to fight like hell to keep them. Many people disagreed with this. They said 1965 was not the time to be doing demonstrations and to be actively fighting for your rights. But
because they was a war going? I mean, there were other things going on?
No, they thought if gay people were just the best little gay people they could be, Americans would say, they're right. They're absolutely right. We should treat them just like we treat everybody. Well, Frank also took his model from the African-American civil rights movement, where he said black people are not going to sit back anymore, and until they fight, they're not going to get their rights. So I think it was a very, very, very smart thing to do. And they were so successful that these annual reminders, as they were called, happened every 4th of July in front of Independence Hall, in front of a crowd of tourists who were there to celebrate the birthday of America.
Well, Otto, you were there in 1969?
In 1969, because... Excuse me. I wasn't a citizen until 1968.
Oh. You were born in Cuba, I should say.
I was born in Cuba, and I had a green card, but I wasn't a citizen. And that was, I mean, for a non-citizen to be caught in any kind of demonstration could mean deportation.
Sure.
And at the time, they didn't have diplomatic relations with United States and Cuba, so they'll put you in jail until such a time in which it will have
so
been
you
a
waited
long time.
To 69 to so you
well 69 I was granted the protection of the Constitution, which is another thing that about the, those actions in front of Independence Hall. I think that they had, for the first time, they actually called attention to the fact that our rights were connected to the Constitution. That, in fact, have been the basis of a lot of our victories in the past 50 years.
In the courts?
Yeah. So I see the gay movement starting way back, and then Stonewall appears as a big inflection point. But it is a continuum.
Well, let me go back to you, Mark Siegel. And it's interesting to talk about what was happening in Philadelphia before Stonewall. And as Adam described, you know, people wearing very nice clothing and looking very professional. The idea is to say, we're just like you. But it seems like Stonewall was saying, no, we're going to do, we're something different. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think there's a little of the timeline we have to correct here. The gay rights movement didn't start with those marches in Philadelphia. In the United States of America, it started in the 1920s in Chicago by a man by name of Henry Gerber. He was the man who created the first LGBT organization for human rights in Chicago and got it registered. Next blip on the dial was a man by the name of Harry Hay, who considered himself a gay fairy. He is the founder of Mattachine. From there, we go to the first picket, which was Randy Wicker outside the induction center in New York, demanding that gay people be allowed to be inducted into the military. Then from there, we go to Compton's riot in San Francisco, where basically trans people fought the police. From there, we go back to Philadelphia for the Dewey sit-in, when they would not allow trans people go into there and be quote-unquote boisterous late at night.
And that was a restaurant in Philadelphia, Dewey's.
Correct. Yeah. Then we go to the Reminders Day, and there's a few other things in between there, which I won't go in. And I think most important thing to state is one of the things that GLF stood for was out loud, in your face, and we're not going to take it anymore, and we are going to fight back. And when we were fighting back, we weren't only fighting back against this society at large. We also were saying, unfortunately, the people of Echo did not represent us anymore, because their tactics were sort of like back in the 1950s civil rights demonstration. We were not going to be like that. And the proof of the schism in the community, and there was a schism in the activist community, was when the people, particularly Barbara Giddings and Frank Kameny, wanted to do another march outside Independence Hall in 1970. Mm-hmm. And Craig Rodwell and Ellen Brody of Gay Liberation Front went to Philadelphia to the Echo Conference and said, no, that's not going to happen. I mean, feel free to do it if you wish, but we're doing something we're calling Christopher Street Liberation Day March in New York. And from that group of not more than 100 out activists nationwide during those marches in Philadelphia, 1 year later at Christopher Street Liberation Day, which is now considered Gay Pride Days around the world, we had 15,000 people march. And the reason we did that and that happened was because we got back and did something that was never done before. We self-identified, and we also said we're going to be in your face. By it being in your face meant no longer being polite. We would go and we would demonstrate against the police and bring that demonstration directly to the police precinct. We would demonstrate against the media. We demonstrated against Village Voice. We demonstrated against the New York Times. We demonstrated against Time Life. We were diversified. We created the first trans organization and invited trans people to be part of our organization. We were no longer going to be just the privileged in the gay community. Hmm. We also invited women to be part of it, or women were part of the founding of Gay Liberation Front, I should say. We invited fairies to be part of our organization. And more importantly for me, at 18 years old, we had a gay youth caucus, which I helped found. We created the first gay community center. We created the concept of having a community and having a community outside of those bars where, like Ada said, we all felt uncomfortable and they were all raided. That was the difference. It was revolutionary, and that's what changed this community and made it a broad gay rights movement that everybody could join.
Well, let me give you a chance, Bob, to respond to that. I mean, obviously movements have many moving parts, and it's important to put all this stuff into some kind of context. How do you see then what happened, I guess, in Philadelphia, and then we shift up to New York, sort of how that expanded and created this much more diverse movement?
It certainly changed the whole tenor of the movement. When I look back on the long, long history of the LGBT rights movement, I see a lot of different streams happening at once. There's an assimilationist movement that says that queer people are just like straight people, except for what they do in bed or except for how they feel about their gender. And the opposite side says, we want no part of this society. This society is built on a lie. And I think there's room for both of those. When I came out in the 70s, in the early 1970s, right after Stonewall, I came out to this amazing world of of bars, of support groups, of newspapers, of lesbian and gay radio and TV shows. But I had assumed I'd always been there, and I didn't realize these were all brand new. And I realized I was at the forefront of something new that was happening. As Mark said, in the 70s, because of what people were doing, it was an era of possibilities. Anything seemed possible.
Did you feel that way,
too? The advocate...
Mark, hold on just one second. Let me just give Ada a chance to respond. Did you feel that way as well?
Yes, definitely. I think that, as I said, the tactics changed, and they were more attuned to the times.
Were you comfortable with those more confrontive tactics?
Well, definitely. I mean, HAL, the Homophile Action League, helped organize the first Memorial March that was in 1970. Mm-hmm. And we were definitely very much part of the transformation. In fact, HAL, I always say, was a bridge between the old tactics and the new tactics. But having homophile in the name, that was dead after Stonewall. No more
it
homophile.
It seems like a very old-fashioned word, I have to say.
Nobody knows today what homophile was, which had come to me as a surprise, because, of course, I was a homophile for a long time.
File meaning love, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, hold on. I just need to quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Ada Bello, and again, a founding member of the Philadelphia chapter of the Daughters of Bilitis, also a word you don't hear a lot, and its successor organization, the Homophile Action League. And she was part of the 1969 Reminder protest here in Philadelphia, protesting for gay rights. Mark Siegel joining us from the NPR studios in New York. He's an LGBTQ activist, founder, publisher of the Philadelphia Gay News, a founding member of the Gay Liberation Front, and Bob Skiba, curator at the William Way Center's LGBT Archives. And we are marking the 50th anniversary of Stonewall and the role that Philadelphia and, frankly, other cities have played as well. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. And I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Mark, I know you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, the whole idea of Gay Liberation Front was visibility. We wanted to get in your face, and we were going to take it to the public. And for me, that meant going to the media and disrupting various TV shows. But that led to something else more important. Every step led to a new step in our movement for equality. So after doing some of the TV zaps, for a couple of years...
And we should say to our listeners, that's what you called it. You would kind of essentially crash a TV show, and you called it zaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did The Tonight Show, The Today Show, CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. And what that led – okay, so the idea of that was to get conversation out there. I didn't care at all what people thought about me. After all, I was hurting Uncle Walter, the most popular trusted man in America. But the idea was so that people at home could talk to their families about who they were. And because we always used to say, we are your uncles, your aunts, your brothers, your sisters, and your cousins. And there will always be someone in your family who is gay. But that led to something else, the next level of what I call gay liberation. So by doing that, I got to meet with Governor Milton Chapp in Pennsylvania. I honestly believe, as a proud Philadelphian and a proud Pennsylvania, I am very proud of our part in gay liberation, and I think it's a major part of our history. So Governor Chapp and I talked, and along with Harry Langhorne, met with the governor. It was the first time any governor in the United States had ever met with gay activists. And we asked him for a couple of things, and surprisingly, he agreed. He issued the first proclamation by any state proclaiming Gay Pride Month. He issued another executive order, which was the first in the nation, which said that LGBT people could not be discriminated in state government, in hiring in state government. Mm. That had never been done anywhere, not only in the United States, anywhere in the world. He then created a council, again, the first in the world, first official governmental panel to look into the problems of gay men and lesbian women around the state of Pennsylvania. These were all incredible acts. And again, Pennsylvania led the way.
Well, let me go back to you then, Bob, as our curator here. Was there something about Pennsylvania that was more forward-thinking when it came to LGBTQ rights?
Well,
or there were just certain people that seemed to have
a better understanding? It had to do with people, and it had to do with the political atmosphere in Philadelphia at the time, too. And it had to do with the political climate in the country. Between 1965 and 1969, when the first and the last Reminder Day happened, the political atmosphere in the country had changed and developed. What had begun as a slightly left-wing movement had become very radical, and I think LGBT activists in the 70s fed into that whole new atmosphere of questioning what was going on.
You mentioned the Gayborhood, which is a very famous now part of Philadelphia. Does the Gayborhood today exist the way it did even 10, 15, 20 years ago?
That's a complex question. Yeah. Do gay people exist the way they did 15
sort
or 20
of, yes,
years
exactly,
ago?
Buried
do
in
they
my
need
question.
The same things? Do they think about themselves the same way? No. Do we still need a Gayborhood? Absolutely. We've come a long way. We still have a long way to go.
But you're saying because gay people are more sort of integrated into the rest of society?
That's one reason. This is a whole other subject
it
here.
Is.
It is. It really is.
Is there a short answer?
Is there a short answer? I don't think there is. I don't think there is.
Mark, we're almost up on a break here. Anything you want to add to that very briefly?
I think there is a point of gay activists today want to get back to the roots of 1969. They want to work intersectionally. We in Gay Liberation Front worked with various black organizations, feminist organizations, Latino organizations. I remember marching in a march to free Angela Davis. I remember marching with the Young Lords. We were intersectional then. And the community once again wants to get back to that root. I think that's really important. I think we need to address issues in our own community. Mm-hmm. Ageism, racism. We need to talk about those issues. We need to worry about the people who are most endangered in our community. At this point, it happens to be trans people. There have been over 40 deaths of trans people since January.
I do want to pick up on that, and we do have to take a very short break. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're marking the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. They began on June 28th, 1969. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. This Friday marks the 50th anniversary of the riots that took place between New York City police and patrons at the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in Greenwich Village, essentially catapulting the LGBTQ civil rights movement into wider public consciousness. We're talking about what happened in New York 50 years ago. Also, the role that Philadelphia, frankly, played in the movement as well. And let me just quickly reintroduce our three guests. Bob Skiba, curator at the William Way Center's John T. Wilcox Junior LGBT Archives. Adebello, a founding member of the Philadelphia chapter of the Daughters of Bilitis and its successor organization, the Homophile Action League, also an active volunteer with the American Library Association's Gay Task Force, a founding member of the LGBT Elder Initiatives. And also with us, Mark Siegel, he's up in New York, an activist, founder, publisher of the Philadelphia Gay News, founding member of the Gay Liberation Front, wrote a book a couple of years ago, And Then I Danced. He was at Stonewall when the riots broke out. And again, you can join us, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Out of something you were saying during the break, which is that the LGBTQ community movement, like anyone else in America, have prejudices just like anyone else. And we should not be surprised or shocked about that.
No, definitely. And I think that we are more prone to bring it out and talk about, which is one way to eventually solve the problem. But we cannot escape the society in which we exist.
Mm-hmm. And you think, I'm curious about why you think others are more comfortable bringing this up than compared to non-gay people, if I can put it that way.
You mean within?
Yeah, within
the movement. Well, we are already, each one of us is a little bit of an outsider. So there is something to be said for that. However, it doesn't mean that everybody sees it that way.
Right. But being an outsider, I do agree with you, being an outsider, you do see things other people don't see. Bob, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see all these letters being added to LGBTQIA, which I absolutely support. Having a name for yourself is just so empowering. It gives you a presence. It gives you a strength. And that's so important. We also have to remember that when we look at all those letters, that the community is not a monolith, mm-hmm. which is so important. As Mark said, we have to appreciate that intersectionality, that diversity.
Let me go back to you, Mark. And I began the show by talking about this poll from the Pew Research Center saying that 61% of Americans support same-sex marriage. And 15 years ago, it was more like 31%. So that's in 15 years, that's a pretty big shift of public opinion. Do you think just that there's so many more people who are out and not getting arrested for being out, that has changed public perception?
Oh, absolutely. And that poll is also mirrored by the Harris poll and also the Williams Institute polls that are now done today. The Harris poll used to show, when I first started doing what I'm doing, that do you believe in homosexual rights, as they put it in those days? Do they have a right to have a job? And at that point, only 32% thought that we did. So over 60% thought we should be fired. Mm. I mean, that's how far we've come. But I'd like to get back to the shift in the gay rights movement,
sure.
Because a lot of that has been written over. And what I've learned here in New York from all the historians is they're beginning to refine that, and they'd like to define it correctly at this time. And we in New York at that time, and I lived in New York from 69 to 71, when I came back to Philadelphia, I came back with that new Gay Liberation Front radicalism. And the organization then in Philadelphia was Gay Activist Alliance. And they had been tried to do what the people at those marches tried to do, which was go for gay rights, which meant getting legislation, which would mean the people could not get fired. And Gay Activist Alliance in Philadelphia could not get that legislation introduced. I then ran for a political chair of Gay Activist Alliance, literally within being back in a month. George Beacon was the chair, and he was not happy with that at all. But in my pushy techniques, I said, elect me chair of the political committee, and I will get that bill introduced. And then I got elected, and I went to city council, and I was in their face. I stayed outside their door. I slept outside their door. That's what that kind of activism does. That bill got introduced. It was Bill 1275, introduced by Bill Boyle and one other, and I believe Councilman Farmer, if
this
I'm correct.
This goes way back, yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah. It took one more time, and we got that bill through. But I fulfilled that promise. And from that point on, I made the point that it was visibility and fighting for your rights, not just asking for your rights. That's what got me to Governor Schapp. That's what got me to Governor Casey. That's what eventually got me to Senator Bob Casey. That's what got me to Senator Obama and then President Obama. The things that were done in Gay Liberation Front live to today. I've been reminded on that every day here in New York. Last night I spoke at SAGE, which is a gay senior organization, and they applauded Philadelphia because we got the John C. Anderson Building, which is the first federally named official LGBT-friendly affordable living building for seniors. That process was brought here to New York, and we brought our expertise from Philadelphia to New York, and very shortly they will be opening the first LGBT-friendly senior affordable building in New York. Philadelphia did it first. That's one of the reasons I'm very proud of Philadelphia.
Well, let me give I had a chance to weigh in on this as a founding board member of the LGBT Elder Initiative.
No, absolutely. I think that the Anderson Apartments are a just a tremendous help to the community, which a community that actually, in economic terms, is mostly affected by lack of funds, particularly when, as they are growing older without family, and in many cases they had partners, but they had died. So I think that is that to me is something I'll be grateful to Mark for the rest of my life.
Ada, I am grateful to you for the rest of my life. You are one of my heroes.
Fair enough. Let me get Kurt from Bucks County to join our conversation. Hi, Kurt. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. You guys are my heroes. I teach queer literature at Kutztown University, and every semester I spend 2 weeks on Stonewall, and the students applaud you guys like you would not believe. You are such heroes. I'm honored to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate it.
Give me an invite, and I'll come to Kutztown.
And you know he will, Kurt.
Oh, you got it. You got it. Peter Staley came to speak to my classes last year about the AIDS crisis. We've got a remarkable program, and I'm telling you, every semester, students stand up and cheer you guys.
Well,
thank
you. Kurt, we'll get your personal information. We'll hook you up with Mark Siegel. But let me give you a chance, Bob, to weigh in on that. And it is interesting to look at what I consider to be a kind of a generational shift, that younger people just seemed, this is sort of seem more matter of fact about, well, of course people would have gay rights. Thanks, Kurt. Yeah, thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Bob.
That's because of all the work that's been done over the last 50, 60 years. I remember in 2015 when marriage equality was still being debated by the Supreme Court, and the most telling thing I heard from those judges were, we need to move slowly. This is all very new. The fact is, it's not very new, as Mark made very clear in his timeline. It's been going on for a long time, and a lot of work done by a lot of people. And it's so important that young people know that this has been going on, and that they have a history, and they have a past, and they have a family. They have a family history.
Anna, do you
and
see
it's another
way?
Point of where LGBT Pennsylvanians can take pride, because Pennsylvania had marriage equality a year before the Supreme Court ruled. Again, Pennsylvania being on the forefront.
Anna, anything you want to add to that?
Well, other than, yes, Pennsylvania, and I think that we should mention this, still doesn't protect sexual orientation and gender identity.
In the workplace, right?
In the workplace. And to that extent, we are really have work to do.
So we have to remember that must pass Congress.
That would be ideal
if
they will actually do it at the federal level. But Pennsylvania had to work on that. And I think that we had advanced a tremendous amount since we started way back in the 60s. However, it is a work in progress. There is still quite a bit to go. And we have to remember that any change of law take times to be assimilated, maybe generations, to go from when people refrain from doing something because the law said don't do it, to the point in which people think, well, I would never dream of doing that.
Let me go back to you, Mark, and I had mentioned a couple of times this Pew Research Center poll about marriage, but I also read that two-thirds of the public oppose the transgender ban in the military, and I thought that was really revealing in so many ways, and I'd be curious about what you make of that.
I think that we, thanks to being more visible, people in society are beginning to know us. If they know us, they're not afraid of us. The best example I can give of a trans person being in public life is Rachel Levine, who happens to be Pennsylvania Health Commissioner. Imagine that. We have a trans person who is a member of the governor's cabinet in Pennsylvania, and there's not a complaint. And she was voted into that position by the Republican-controlled Senate of Pennsylvania, a Senate that up to this point has not passed an equal protection law into the laws of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania. I think that you've seen a lot of trans people on TV, on talk shows, and as characters, and on Netflix movies. Therefore, once you get to know somebody, you're not afraid of them anymore. They're not the monsters in the closets that myth would allow.
It's all about visibility.
I cannot say that enough.
I hear you. A visibility. You agree, Bob?
I absolutely agree. Mark, I could not agree with you more. In my 40 years of doing LGBT history, I think the biggest lesson that I've taken away is that the most political thing queer people have done, people who are different have done, is to refuse to be invisible, to make sure their voices are heard. It makes all the difference in the world.
And made a difference in your life, right? I mean, this is a personal thing besides a political thing, I'm assuming.
Absolutely. I think for anyone, we realize that what starts off as the personal becomes the general and the political.
I'm Barney Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Mark, let me go back to you. What then, looking ahead, I mean, it is interesting to have this conversation. You mentioned the fact that 40 trans people have been murdered this year so far. We also have Pete Buttigieg running for president of the United States. You've got a lesbian who's the mayor of Chicago. So it's interesting to see these, almost like these parallel tracks going on. And what do you make of that?
It's difficult to wrap my head around it, but what I've left New York with, I've been amazed. I'm one of the few people who is alive that can be documented, that was at Stonewall, member of Gay Liberation Front, went on to do all these other things. And therefore, media craze this week, and that has really surprised me. And I also, there are various conferences of historians here, and they do something which has absolutely shocked me. They think I have been timid in telling my history. And why that makes me funny is the original title of my book, which I wanted and my publisher didn't, was Pushy Fag Jew.
Oh, jeez. I can understand why they put the brakes on that one. But no, go ahead, Mark.
And I remember when I wanted to build this senior project and everyone said it was impossible, a state representative by the name of Mike O'Brien said to me, Mark, you have to go back to your roots and be pushy again.
Oh, interesting.
And so now I've decided that all the revisionist history, as I think I've done on this radio show, I'm going to be out there. I'm going to be making sure it's correct and not glossed over. You'll see a piece coming out very shortly from David Carter, who will correct his misimpressions of that whole first magical year from Stonewall through the first gay pride march, which I believe changed this community forever and was the spark to get where we are today, to a Pete Buttigieg, to two senators in the United States Senate, to mayors in numerous towns around the country, including Chicago and Tampa.
Yeah, and Mark,
and I think there's many more to come.
Let me jump in only because I want to give Ada the last word. Looking ahead, what do you see in your crystal ball?
Well, it'd be easy to conceive this as something that cannot be stopped. We had to be aware that there will be setbacks. And which means that we had to be vigilant. That doesn't mean that we will not celebrate and feel comfortable with what we have. But you cannot, as I said before, I think that this is a work in progress, and the fight is it still goes on.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Adabella, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And Mark Siegel, thank you for joining us up there in New York on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Bob Skiba, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Henson. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.